With Spring Black Friday deals at the Home Depot, you can give your lawn or garden beds a pop of color and protection. Right now, get a special buy on Scott's Earth Grow Mulch, 5 bags for just $10. Help your soil retain moisture longer with color that lasts up to 12 months. Shop Spring Black Friday deals for a special buy on Scott's Earth Grow Mulch, 5 bags for just $10 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. Color selection varies by store. Limit 60 bags per customer while supplies last.
Are you a Henry? It stands for high earner, not rich yet. It means that despite earning a six-figure income, you're struggling to amass any meaningful nest egg. Our friends at The Motley Fool can help. Since 1993, they've been providing investment advice, helping members build the financial future they envision. To kickstart your 2021 financial goals, they're offering 5 of their favorite stock picks for free. Realizing you're a Henry? Remember the not rich yet part. You can do it, and The Motley Fool can help. Visit fool.com/best bets.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Sports Grid Fantasy Football Podcast. My name is Davis Maddock. I'm joined today by Matt Friedman with the news that the NFL and the NFLPA have agreed to a testing protocol. Seems like no preseason games, Matt, but if I was a gambling man, I think I would be gambling on there being a 16-game NFL season. I think officially a 16-game season has to be considered the favorite.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a couple minds of this one. I just have to say, it was necessary to sacrifice the preseason, but yes. We should take a moment to mourn, because preseason was wonderful, both just in terms of DFS and betting on it. So too bad we don't have a preseason, but you know, you sacrifice what you have to. I agree that we are likely to get a 16-game season. I've been, you know, optimistic and pessimistic about a lot of things with the way NFL has handled this situation. I've always been optimistic that in some fashion we would have a season. The big question was, would it start on time? Would we end up having 16 games? Would there be some sort of unfortunate pause in the middle of the season?
Right.
And then even if there's not a pause in the middle of the season, do they have protocols in place that will hopefully limit the number of players who are exposed to COVID? So, like, I was thinking in a worst case scenario, the NFL might play games, but they might end up being so ravaged with COVID to where at some points it looks like basically an exhibition game, or looks like a lockout situation where there are scabs out there playing. Right, like, or scab level
again.
Type of
again, I think I would make that the betting favorite, that the NFL, come hell or high water, they're yes. playing games, but yeah. Levi Mitchell is going to be on the field. You know, right. Kristen Michael is going to get a call. Lance Dunbar, you know, we're going to see Lance Dunbar on an active roster. You know, some of these guys that we saw in the XFL, the CFL is not having a season, which, by the way, I actually think is kind of a weird wrinkle in all of this, that like, some of these CFL wide receivers, yeah. you know, Mike Riley, Jeremiah Masoli and stuff. Like, I seriously would not be surprised to see CFL players playing this season in the NFL.
Yeah, I mean, that is a wrinkle of it. Like, I think there will be some games where, because of the COVID situation, we end up having exposure to players that we wouldn't have dreamt of 3 months ago. Guys we don't even remember, you know, from their days in college football. We will be reminded of those guys at some point. But I agree. I do think we have a season. I would say it's likely to be 16 games. I think there's a scenario where it's like either 16 games or like 10 games. You know what I mean? Like something,
yes.
something really drastic would have to happen in the next month for them to abbreviate the season and push back the start date. But I feel very certain one way or another, we are going to have football.
So in my home league, you know, the one that I actually care about with like all my buddies from high school and college and stuff, you know, I'm still sweating this league out on Sundays, despite the entry fee being like one GPP entry, basically. this is what we did. We added 3 IR slots. We did not add any extra bench slots, but basically just under the assumption that because what's proposed, what Pro Football Talk reported, was that there is this proposed 3-week minimum IR stint when you test positive. So Matt Stafford tests positive for COVID. He goes on the 3-week IR, and then, you know, he's just not eligible to play until after that point. If that is what ends up happening, 3 IR slots, you know, might not be enough. My guess is probably that it just ends up being 1 week, and if you're clear after that, you're asymptomatic and you don't test positive at the end of that week, you can return to practice and play. But that my basic suggestion for home leagues would just be, you know, add as many IR slots. Like I think you could add like 5 or whatever, because what are you really hurting by adding IR slots? You know, it's like guys exactly. who yeah. So I think that is my main suggestion. That would be my advice.
Yeah, I like that idea. It's a similar situation in my longtime dynasty league, you know, with buddies from high school. You know, I've talked with the commissioner. We're probably going to have more IR spots. And I don't think it even needs to be like, okay, the normal IR spots are for guys who are really injured, and then you have some COVID IR spots. Because, like, who wants to be the commissioner who's, like, managing that and looking at that? Just have more open IR spots, and you manage it however it is that the league is managing it. The NFL is managing IR. And then I also think one thing that teams or that leagues might want to consider is going with a head-to-head best ball strategy, so that you continue to have the ability to add players off of waivers. You can do trades. You still have your head-to-head matchup, so you can have like that rivalry of playing against the guy who beat you in the championship game 2 years ago. You still have all of that friends and family league dynamic, but on Thursday night, Sunday morning, you don't have to set your roster. You don't have to worry if there's going to be some late scratch because of COVID or something like that, and then you have to get a quarterback out of your lineup. You just have the best ball matchup during your actual head-to-head matchups. I think that is maybe an optimal way of doing this, or at least it might take out some of the headache that people might have on Sunday mornings if there are a slew of COVID announcements.
So I just think that will just not happen in mini leagues, right? Because like, yeah. Like home leagues, that like a lot of people listening to this show, I'm sure you know, like it was probably a battle to get PPR added. Like I'm sure you're still trying to get super flex added to your league, right?
Many leagues are.
I think IR most reasonable people can be like, you right. know, whatever. Like, let's do that. I also think, by the way, this is just an obvious point that I need to make, but you know, no strategy for fantasy football benefits more. And this is a point that Peter Overzet made on the TakeCast last week. But you know, no strategy is going to benefit more from the 3-week IR for COVID than zero running back.
Zero
because
RB. Yeah.
Because running backs, like, so Michael Thomas goes on to IR for 3 weeks. Traquan Smith doesn't become Michael Thomas. But if Alvin Kamara goes on the IR for 3 weeks, Latavius Murray becomes Alvin Kamara in his absence. So
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's just amplified number of injuries that we could see this year, and injuries always favor the backup running back more than the backup tight end or backup wide receiver. So I think it is. I mean, I hate to be the guy who's like, this is the year for zero RB, because I mean, one, you're inevitably going to be wrong. And then two, like, it's always the year for zero RB. But no, this really is, it seems like a scenario in which if you approach zero RB intelligently, you could be set up for significant success.
Yeah. In terms of like overall strategy, I think really the back end of your bench in weekly management league should be like all second and third string wide receiver or running backs, like backup tight ends, rookie wide receivers. I think that if the season plays out how you and I are kind of imagining it, where guys are not seriously injured but just not able to play or be with the team due to testing positive for COVID, just you're going to want as many, you know, Jordan Chuns as possible, basically.
Yeah, I think it's a reasonable way to, I think even in normal circumstances, build your roster. You know, being stronger at wide receiver and then just trying to load up on as many of those running backs who, if they get a shot, actually have the ability of maximizing the upside of that shot. I think that's a way to approach it. That's the way I'm going to approach a lot of it.
Yeah. So this is a good transition point, because I do have to admit something, Matt, which is that zero running back is not a good fit for the underdog draft best ball championship. I actually think you go mega super hyper fragile and start like four running backs, and you know, with these drafts. So for people who don't know, the Underdog app and site just launched this last week. It's effectively the draft app, but repackaged. You know, a lot of the same people worked on it. It's a $1 million prize pool, $200,000 to first place. Our buddy, Michael Leone, over at Establish the Run, has already published some early analysis that basically shows that, you know, because the playoffs start so early, and this is also true in, you know, the FFPC, where the main event, the Football Guys Players Championship, there's so much emphasis on accruing points over like those first 6, 7, 8 weeks, that waiting for Tony Pollard, waiting for Justice Hill, waiting for Darwin Thompson. You know, these are the guys that crept up into the, like literally these guys were going in the top 100 picks last year. It just is like setting a nuclear bomb onto your team, because you're just taking week after week of zeros, like waiting for them.
Yeah, it's kind of similar to some of the strategy with how you would draft quarterbacks. So let's say like in a normal world, you maybe project the number of fantasy points that you expect a quarterback to have over the entirety of the season. That actually kind of doesn't matter when it comes time to draft some of these guys if you're not going to draft a quarterback in the top six. What really matters is what a quarterback schedule looks like for maybe like the first 4 to 6 weeks of the season, or maybe even just the first week of the season if you're drafting him late enough. Like, you're wanting to target points within a specific time frame. And so for Underdog, yeah, you want to target your points. You want to maximize points at the beginning of the season, just like with, you know, drafting quarterbacks. You're really just kind of looking at what a guy is going to do for the first couple of weeks, and then after that you're going to be streaming. It's a similar thing of like focusing your point potential within a time period.
So it's weird to be drafting in those formats when I'm so used to, obviously, like I'm never taking Melvin Gordon, I'm never taking David Johnson, I really don't even ever take Todd Gurley. But in specifically the Underdog Best Ball Championship, in these leagues where, you know, where it really is all about accruing those points early, making it to the playoff period, and then having guys who, like, because really you truly care about nothing else other than how do I get the most points out of, you know, I don't even know how many entries it is. I'm guessing just off the top of my head, it's got to be something like, you know, 400,000 or right. Whatever.
It's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. And you have no ability to pick up Ty Johnson. You have no ability to grind the waivers, and just on the way things are going to play out more often, you'd much rather start with, you know, four super high T running backs, you know, the high T most possible start. And you could even go super hypofragile and only draft those four running backs, right? And have 10 wide receivers basically.
Right. And it's a best ball approach, correct? So, you know, what you're focusing on with your wide receivers is a little bit different than what you would be doing in your friends and family league, where you want some of those really consistent, high floor, high ceiling wide receivers that you can lock in on a weekly basis. In best ball, not nearly as important. You're just kind of, if a guy's boom or bust, that doesn't matter, because in part that means you can get him a little bit cheaper, which is great. You're just focused on, does he have that ceiling? Does he have the potential to give me 6 to 8 weeks that really pay off? And you can cobble together a wide receiver unit like that. So yeah, I mean, I think maybe the way to do it is to just take your shots on wide receivers later, and then build that foundation, which might be weak, of running backs, but maybe it pays off if these guys stay healthy and they can carry you.
So which of the hyper fragile running backs do you like? Because everyone, high T, low T, it doesn't matter. Yeah. Everyone sucks. You know, some people like Todd Gurley, some people like James Conner, some people like Leonard Fournette. Like everyone has their guy. Who are the Matt Friedman hyper fragile targets?
James Conner. Absolutely, yeah. Love him. because he's big. He has the ability to score touchdowns. For a bigger guy, he's actually pretty good in the pass catching role. And I do expect that Pittsburgh offense to be better this year in general, just because Ben Roethlisberger is there. And so I think that will mean more extended drives, more yardage opportunities, and more touchdown opportunities. And I know that Connor is sort of like quote unquote fragile, but I actually don't really know if that's true. Like, that's just, you know, the word on the street about him. But I mean, I think it's more reasonable than not to think that if you had to project the number of games he plays this year, it's probably around 14 to 15 games, you know? And if Connor is there 14 to 15 games, like, I think he's the locked in lead back who has the opportunity to smash. So at his ADP, I really do like him a lot. Cam Akers, I'm not buying the, you know, the hype of him right. just being a guy who has to, like, sure, he will have to compete with the veterans who are there, but I expect him to win that battle pretty easily. And like the Pittsburgh offense, the Rams offense, I also expect to be a little bit better than it was last year. And people are, I think, overselling how bad it was last year.
They were like the 10th best offense in football.
It was still a top 12 offense. The Rams have had a top 12 offense all 3 years under Sean McVay. Like, there are reasons to think that that offense could still be decidedly above average. And if that's the case, I think Cam Akers has the talent and he'll have the opportunity to put up a lot of points. So those are the two guys shooting from the hip who are going outside of the top 12, outside of the top 15, that I think have a pretty realistic chance of finishing in the top 12. So those would be some of the guys that I would be looking to anchor if I'm going, let's say, with three or four straight running backs. Hopefully I can get those two guys as my second and third or third and fourth running backs.
I have to admit, I do see a path for Melvin Gordon where he just scores like 13 or 14 touchdowns or whatever. And yeah. like Philip Lindsay can still catch 50 passes. Philip Lindsay can still get 150 carries, you know, kind of like Austin Eckler last year, but just Melvin Gordon is eternal. He just is always going to be there on the goal line slogging away.
Well, one thing that's so frustrating about Lindsay is that he's not as good in the receiving game as he should be for a guy of his size and speed, right? So Melvin Gordon, he's going to have more carries. He's going to have the goal line opportunities, and he's probably like the better pass catching back. So like Lindsay might get a decent number of empty yards, but he's not going to have like the protein
he's actually going to get the trap touches where like yeah. whereas like he got all the good touches last year and Royce Freeman got all the trap touches. Melvin Gordon, like it's actually going to be the inverse of the way it was in Los Angeles for Melvin Gordon last right. year yeah. where, I mean, Eckler still got targets, but Gordon was getting targets and had a monopoly on the goal line. And despite being like Melvin Gordon is not a good running back, even relative to what we expect running backs to do. But for whatever reason, his teams always give him the good touches. I also think the same thing could be true, by the way, for Todd Gurley, where, you know, he gets like 18 touches a game and then is like hermetically sealed in a chamber in between games. So his knees stay fine. But six of those interactions are targets and the rest of them are all carries inside the 20.
Yeah, he does have the potential for those goal line opportunities, and I do expect that Atlanta offense to continue to be just as good as it has been for the past 3 years. One more guy, I mean, Ronald Jones, is that too easy and also too stupid to say?
No, everyone, I mean, he doesn't count. Ronald Jones, well, I did just see that he just went in the fifth round of a Football Guys Players Championship last night when Pat and Pete were drafting, and it caused Corain to go like fully apoplectic. But I mean, I think Ronald Jones still counts as a zero running back guy because I think Akers does too, by the way.
Okay.
Like, right. So like, for example, you know, in Sean's zero running back list that he puts out every year, Miles Sanders was the number one guy last year. And Cam Akers is the number one zero running back guy for me because, I mean, what do you want Sean McVay to say? What do you, when he drafts Cam Akers, what you want him to be like, yeah, you know, we gave Daryl a try and, you know, he doesn't understand anything right. about what we're doing. Malcolm Brown is slower than some of our offensive linemen. Like what do you realistically want right. him to say? Like they want Cam Akers to be the lead back like Gurley, I think.
Right. They spoke with the draft capital they invested in him. Like that's, that's what counts. And then also just what he can naturally do as a player and what he carried with him as a recruit and then as a prospect. Like he's the best back on that team, and I think that's going to be a pretty decent team. I would push back. I mean, it's hard to know about like how to characterize some of these guys, but you know, if in your normal drafts, Cam Akers is going around maybe like running back 24-ish or something like that, and then Ronald Jones is going maybe like running back 30-ish, like you maybe think of those as, you know, some of the guys that you can get as the running back one in a zero RB approach. But I would think of those as the later running backs I could get in a robust
in a hyper fragile approach.
Yeah, go with a robust running back approach. So and those are the last running backs that you get.
The last 4 days in the Football Guys Players Championship, using this data from fantasymojo.com, Cam Akers, 56th overall, running back 26, Ronald Jones, 69th, nice overall, running back 32. Yeah. So running back ADP is so strange because, like, first of all, Jones and Vaughn going in between like 10 picks of each other, like that's just the market totally throwing its hands up. And you don't really see that all that often. Even last year in the Buccaneers backfield, there was a pretty big split between Ronald Jones and Peyton Barber in their right. ADP. And like we're seeing this huge divide in between Darius Geis's ADP and Antonio Gibson's ADP. Generally, you would expect those guys, you know, it seems weird to me. And what do you think about Tevin Coleman at running back 38 versus where Mostert is going right now?
I mean, I just kind of want to stay away from the Shanahan backfield, but I think in a medium outcome, Mostert has a pretty good season. Like I think the most likely scenario is that he enters camp, he has the job, he keeps the job, he continues to do something fairly close to what he did the past 8 games of the season, something like that. But I mean, certainly Coleman can work in, and if Mostert falters a little bit, I think it becomes a pretty even split between them. I think Mostert has, I think his median outcome is still really good, but he has a ton of downside risk that I just don't want exposure to.
So you're not gobbling up Jerick McKinnon with your last pick in a ton of these leagues. I am. I can't. Imagine quitting before the miracle happens, Matt.
I mean, Chris Raybon had a pretty good comment a couple of months ago, like when we saw that he's still yet to cut while running. And I can't remember exactly. I can't phrase it the way Raybon did, but it's something about like how there's one more cut coming for him, and it's him, you know, like being cut from the 49ers. I mean, that's possible. We could also see McKinnon somehow work his way back, but like the dude hasn't played in 2 years. Like I don't want to get Marcus Lattimore. You know what I mean? I just kind of want to stay away from it at this point.
He's McKinnon's probably a guy who is better in weekly management than best ball because, oh, yeah. like nothing is actually worse for best ball rosters than guys who get hurt. Like you would rather have you'd rather have guys who kind of like, you know, do not meet ADP, don't end up exceeding value or anything, but just like stay healthy for 16 games as opposed to guys who literally just week after week, it's stone cold zeros.
Yeah. Zeros are death in best ball. So yeah, McKinnon is a guy I have no exposure to at all.
So something that impacts what we are talking about, which is, you know, obviously just a structural approach to fantasy football, as opposed to just picking the best players, right, is that in best ball, you are not forced to really deal with the weekly variance of wide receivers. Like generally speaking, if you draft 7 wide receivers, 8 wide receivers, and they're all guys who are good draft picks, right, who meet the criteria of like guys who can exceed value where they go, like the insane variance of wide receiver scoring just gets smoothed out for you by the nature of the way the points are scored. And it's not, that's just not the way that it works in weekly management, right? It's not the way it works in your 12 team league with your buddies. It's not the way it works in these high stakes leagues where you are setting your lineup every single week. Like I think that's actually kind of one of the biggest things right now in fantasy football that people are, I think they used to understand this, but because of how pass heavy the league has gone and there are, you know, so many wide receivers that people like, we have lost our grip on the idea that weekly wide receiver scoring is still super high variance.
So a couple of things. One, Davis, I do just draft the best players, That's my approach.
That's the oracle, buddy.
That's how I do it.
You're the oracle. I
go for that within the structural approach. But the second thing here is thinking about the variability, the volatility in wide receiver scoring. I think it gets – so, one, I agree with you, and it's something that needs to be said. On the other hand, I do think that it gets smoothed out a little bit, especially – okay, so if you have a roster of starting lineup of only, like, eight guys, then your wide receiver peaks and valleys matter much more. But if you're playing in a super flex league and then you also have additional flexes, if you are starting 11 players – then the peaks and valleys of wide receiver scoring get smoothed out just a little bit more.
Because everyone else is having to start wide receiver fours.
Right, exactly. So it doesn't matter as much. And just because you have more guys who can make up for a shortfall in wide receiver scoring, it doesn't matter quite as much if you have a bigger starting lineup. But yeah, I mean, the volatility is something that I'm attuned to pretty heavily. And it certainly impacts the way that I think people should be ranking and the way that people should be drafting. That said, I also kind of, I push back just a little against what I just said, because I'm always shooting for upside anyway, when it comes to those picks, like outside of the top five, you know what I mean? So like outside of the first five rounds, I lean more towards upside in my rankings, and upside tends to favor like the guys who have the volatile scoring, because maybe they catch fire one year and instead of having like the boom bust, they just boom. So it does matter and it does factor in, but I'm always a little uncertain as to how much it does factor in.
So if I can push back on that idea a little bit, yeah. I think this is the trap that people fall into. I like Mecole Hardman. I like Will Fuller. Who are other guys that go late that people really like, and they're like, oh, I can draft my wide receiver one in the eighth round.
Okay, well that's trash.
Yeah. I mean, we saw this happen in the Scott Fishbowl, right? People pounded quarterbacks, people pounded running backs, people pounded tight ends, starting four running backs, taking two quarterback or three quarterbacks by the ninth round, and just being like, oh, well, things are gonna work out for me because I like these specific guys, you know. And I think that is definitely not understanding the weekly variance that you're signing yourself up for. Because what you're doing with that strategy is you're like doubling up on the hyperfragility, right? So you're doubling up on you're going, okay, all these running backs are going to stay healthy and produce relative to their ADP. And these wide receivers that have these really fragile roles, you know, certainly you're not projecting eighth round wide receivers for 150 targets. And like, you know, just some weeks, like, Mecole Hardman is going to like literally not record a point, right? He's going to play 40% of the snaps, be targeted twice, not catch either of them, and not score a point. And like Hardman is a great guy to target. I think he has, of all the wide receivers, you know, year over year, you know, going from 80 PPR points to 200 PPR points, I think Hardman has one of the best chances of doing that. But there also is this huge floor with him where Watkins and Robinson just end up playing over him all year long. And he gets 40 targets and scores six touchdowns again. But so like, I actually think that zero wide receiver in that way of like really going zero wide receiver is an even more hyper fragile strategy, because you have to choose to start these guys on a weekly basis.
Yeah. In best ball, it's totally different. And I think it's manageable. In your seasonal leagues where you have to rely on consistency, you have to pick the guy you're starting. It's really hard to rely on Will Fuller as your number one wide receiver. I would say, I'm sure you remember Fantasy Douche back in the day had this, he sort of noticed that everyone would say something like, oh, I like this guy in a GPP, which like excuses all manner of just irresponsible drafting and lineup building behavior. And I feel like people sometimes like in big tournaments, they kind of have this approach of like, well, it's basically a GPP. I'm competing against all of these other teams, so I need to do things that are outside the box. And it's like, okay, yeah, like that makes sense, but to a degree. And so the approach of going with some of these wide receivers late as the guys that you have to rely on, it's not likely to work out if you're just anchored to their volatility. It can work much better in best ball, but not in your standard redraft leagues.
Yeah, and I mean, there are some guys who are clearly better in best ball than they are in weekly management. And on the converse, there are guys who are better in weekly management than in best ball. Like kind of thinking someone like Julian Edelman, right? Like, well, maybe like Patriots Julian Edelman, I guess, where I don't know what to expect out of Cam Newton and Julian Edelman's connection. Does not seem like a great stylistic fit there. But I saw so many people do this in the Scott Fishbowl is where I saw them do it, where they would, they take two tight ends. They started, they took Lamar and they took Matt Stafford or whatever. And then they loaded up on these running backs and then they were leaving themselves, just totally with these upside stories at wide receiver, which is what the zero running back strategy is, where like I took J.K. Dobbins and Tariq Cohen as like the guys that I'm going to have to start. Just because I left myself in that position, but then a bunch of guys that are hopeful. But this actually goes back to how we started the show, which is if and when those guys become usable, they're going to be in clearly defined roles. I'm not going to be gambling on like, oh, should I start Chase Edmonds this week? Like it's going to be a binary decision of yes, I will, or no, I won't. Whereas you do not have those binary decisions with wide receivers.
Yeah. The binary with the wide receivers is you start Will Fuller, and there are weeks where he gives you like 1 to 2 fantasy points, and then weeks where he gives you like 20 to 30 points. That's the binary. And, but you can never anticipate that with any sort of predictiveness, what Will Fuller will do in any given week. So yeah, if you anchor yourself to those volatile wide receivers, I don't know, you're opening yourself up to a lot of downside if they are like your number one. Like Will Fuller so I have him in the Scott Fishbowl. He's my number 5 wide receiver. I feel really good with him there.
Yeah, but people were drafting him as their first wide receiver. Right.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to go there. So I do actually want exposure to some of these volatile guys, but I want that exposure later in my draft to where if this guy pops, I have him in my depth and maybe I put him in my lineup that week or, something, but it's like, at least I have him, cause I do think Will Fuller, if he's healthy. Yeah. I mean, he has the potential if he stays healthy, which is a massive if, but like to put up 1200 yards and like 10 touchdowns, like he has that potential. Like DeSean Jackson, I think is someone who's kind of in that mold where if he's healthy, he has the potential to put up 1,000 yards. And he's going as, like wide receiver 50, 55, something like that.
Right.
And so, like, there are these volatile guys where you wouldn't want them as your number one, but they provide excellent depth.
Yeah. Okay, so who are some of the breakout wide receivers that that the Oracle is targeting? Guys going after pick 150 or whatever that you are, like, actively trying to get in your drafts.
Oh, man. Define breakout, and I need to look at some ADP stuff here, but kind of define what you mean by breakout. Like, can it be a guy who is has maybe already like had some success, but I just think is going too late?
It could be that. I'm more thinking like everyone wants to find this year's DJ Shark, right? And I think there are some candidates for that guy, but also it could be guy who went from. Like when Jordy Nelson went from being a special teams guy to being a guy who got 60 catches, right? Like that intermediate step. I think that's reasonable too.
Okay, yeah, that's reasonable. So I'm bringing up some FFPC ADP right now, and then starting to look at some of these guys. You said like outside of the top, 150.
Yeah. Right? So like the first guy that people bring up all like is N'Keal Harry, right? So he was hurt last year. Yeah. He looked decent when he played, probably is actually a better stylistic fit with Cam Newton than he would have been with Tom Brady, where it's kind of just like Cam likes to put the ball up there. And N'Keal Harry, for how good he was at ASU, he's very similar to how Kelvin Benjamin was used at the NFL level, where like he's not, yes. he's just going to be in one-on-one matchups with good cornerbacks and be expected to win those matchups basically.
Yeah. There's definitely some Devin Funchess to his game. Okay, so one guy, and like, I don't know if it's fair to say that he's a breakout because he's someone that I think has had success but is still going way too late, and that's Mike Williams.
He's he already broke out and then he unbroke out because everything was such a mess with the Chargers last year, but I'm 100% on board.
Yeah, I mean, he's available as the wide receiver 50. And like, so last year he had 1,000 yards receiving, and the year before that he had double digit touchdowns.
Yeah, he had 11 touchdowns.
This isn't a guy who should be going this late in drafts. And
this isn't Brandon Ayuk.
Right. Obviously, I know there was a quarterback change, but I mean, Williams for 2 years has just been so consistently efficient on his usage that even if it bumps up just a little bit and he experiences some positive touchdown,
if Keenan Allen gets hurt, or and Melvin Gordon's not on the team, so they're not going to, every time they get inside the 5 yard line, they're not going to be running the ball.
Yeah, exactly. So I think there's a lot of upside with Mike Williams. So I like him at wide receiver 50. This one I feel a little bit dirty about saying, and it doesn't really fit in with what you're saying, but it does a little bit. Sammy Watkins at wide receiver, was it like 55?
Yeah, I really can't help myself with Sammy Watkins.
I can't either. Like, he provides, I think, something pretty close to the upside of Mecole Hardman, but he's available.
I mean, not only that, week one, he is going to play more snaps than Mecole Hardman. You can write that in stone right now.
Right. You know, like, I think there's a pretty decent chance, like, he just outproduces Mecole Hardman this year, and he should be going ahead of him. We can't say that Sammy Watkins doesn't have upside. Like, we know he has upside. The question is just, can he stay healthy? But, you know, that's something that's really hard to predict. But I like Watkins at wide receiver 53. Another guy who is calling to me, I mentioned him earlier, DeSean Jackson at wide receiver 56. Like, that's not really like sexy. That's not at all like a breakout, but like, he hasn't been healthy the past 2 years. It's just a question of, can he stay healthy? But he could easily, I think, lead them
in targets. Probably not targets, but in yards.
In air yards, he could lead them. So he's someone that I think is going just way too late. And then like, you have some of these other guys, like, the question is, how do you think about rookies with the COVID situation? I think either they're going to be significantly disadvantaged, or there might be some guys who are still just so talented that it kind of doesn't matter, and they end up going far later than they should in drafts because people are just ignoring them. Henry Ruggs is someone who might kind of fit in that range, but he's going probably a little bit too early to be thought of based on like the question that you asked. And also, there just might not be enough targets for him this year. But Ruggs is someone who really does intrigue me.
So my favorite rookie wide receiver, where they go, it's LaVisca Chenault. And this is definitely influenced by Pat Corain, who is the foremost LaVisca Chenault truther. But there is a pretty clear path to me where, you know, he plays right away over Conley and Dede Westbrook and is getting, you know, like, let's say 80 targets, right? Which is, you know, not great, but is certainly more than many wide receivers who are going around him. But also, Chenault was like a wildcat quarterback and ran for touchdowns in college. And like, the number one thing we know is Leonard Fournette is like the least efficient goal line running back of all time. It seriously would not be like a world-shattering outcome to see Chenault run for like 4 touchdowns.
Yeah. I'm expecting him to get, just in terms of like the wide receiver position, basically like the Cordarrelle Patterson treatment in terms of like the touches out of the backfield that he gets.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, so I think he's going to be used pretty heavily as a runner. But that at all doesn't take away from what he can do as a receiver.
As a receiver.
On a per target basis, he was up there in his 2 final seasons of college with the best wide receivers in this class that was just drafted. Like, he was up there with Higgins and Judy and CeeDee Lamb just in terms of like his per target efficiency. So there's a lot to like about Chenault. And I think his enthusiasm or like lack, sorry, his athleticism or lack of athleticism at the combine was really overplayed.
Well, the groin. Like,
he was still super athletic for his size, and he had an injury. He basically had Davante Adams' athleticism plus 15 extra pounds of muscle.
And was doing that on a groin that he got surgically repaired immediately after the combine.
Right. So he's much more athletic than the combine would lead you to believe. A couple of guys going super late that I think provide some value, and they're kind of similar. KJ Hamler, and I feel dirty saying that, but like going as the wide receiver 93, like I think there's a scenario where he has maybe some like rookie year T.Y. Hilton type of potential.
Yeah.
You know, like if Judy gets injured or Judy just kind of doesn't perform, like Hamler's the speedster on that team. And, you know, he was productive in college. Like there are reasons to be enthusiastic about him. And then Andy Isabella. I can't quit him, but you know, wide receiver 95. I don't even think
it's just like he was playing at UMass 18 months ago. Like, so what if he wasn't ready to play in the NFL right away? Like, what did you really expect from him? Like, I guess it's really not good that Keyshawn Johnson played at Fresno State and played over him, I guess. But like, I don't know. They made a lot of weird decisions last year. The Cardinals made a lot of weird personnel decisions.
Yeah. And one more here who is much more of a deeper dive, but Devin DuVernay, who's going as the wide receiver 97, you know, speedster out of UT, was productive his final year of college, you know, was a, like, I think 4-star recruit entering college, and plays in the slot. And so in Baltimore, I think
a little Diggsy.
A little bit, but I mean, didn't have, the immediate production in college that Stephon Diggs had. But, you know, in Baltimore, I could see a situation where pretty quickly he ends up beating out Willie Snead as the slot guy. And if that offense passes a little bit more, I mean, you're going to have a situation where you have two pretty athletic wide receivers on the outside in Marquise Brown and Miles Boykin attracting a lot of attention. But DuVernay has sub 4.4 speed. Like, if he's stretching the seam and going deep, like, I could see him actually having some really big weeks. So he's someone who's kind of intriguing to me as a guy who's just way off of the radar.
So I am not on DuVernay because I am a big Boykin guy. Like, yeah. I think there is – it's so easy to see how it works out for him. They lose 457 Hayden Hurst snaps. Lamar Jackson throws only 404 passes last year. I think you can pretty comfortably project him for like 100 more passes than he threw last season. And, you know, so Boykin is kind of, you know, he's more like that big bodied, like he could play in the slot, right? And kind of like kind of play those, like run those tight end routes, especially near the red zone. And, you know, obviously Marquise Brown is going to be the deep threat, but, you know, would not surprise me if Boykin ends up like third or fourth on that team in targets and scores like 8 touchdowns, because that's the guy he profiles as the touchdown scorer.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And looking at Boykin versus DuVernay, I probably have like rookie enthusiasm with DuVernay and I'm overlooking Boykin. Like, I have Boykin projected higher. Like, he certainly has the higher median outcome. So he's probably the sharper guy to draft, considering that they're going very much in the same range. But there's something about DuVernay. I like those rookies. I like those fast guys.
Let's see. Oh, James Washington is the other one for me. As like being like, is Deontay Johnson really that good? I don't know. I think I'm not that convinced, but there are a lot of people who are very convinced.
I think he's probably decent, but I don't know if he's that much better than James Washington. You know,
and so
I would rather take the arbitrage.
Well, and this is a team that's not going to throw to its tight ends at all, right? Eric Ebron, Vance McDonald, those guys are going to combine for like 90 targets probably. And, you know, the last time we saw healthy Ben, they led the NFL in passing attempts. Smith-Schuster, you know, not the second coming of Jerry Rice that some people, myself. Yeah, like maybe this is not a guy that earns a 33% target share. or anything crazy like that. So like there's 100 targets there for James Washington, even if he does, like if he breaks out a little bit, right? Like there's a very good season for him there. And you know, I'd probably make it like 2-1 that he outproduces, or maybe like 3-1 that he outproduces Diontae Johnson, and he is free, right? He just is stone cold free.
Wow. So you think he actually does outproduce Diontae Johnson this year?
I don't think that's the most likely outcome, but I would not be surprised if he did. Okay. Like James Washington is, well, I guess the problem with James Washington is, right, he is more of a classic NFL wide receiver fit, like, you know, 6'2", 210, plays on the outside, whereas Diontae Johnson is like the new NFL of, you know, small, really agile, you know, runs the slant routes really well, you know, is gonna just gobble up those slot targets. So maybe that ends up just really like Washington is a more high variance selection for sure, where like his whole season could be made or broken on like 3 deep targets. And if he catches those deep targets, his numbers look great. And if he has the Mike Williams season from last year, you know, obviously probably not on as much of a target volume, he ends up being a massive disappointment.
Yeah, I mean, big picture, I think I want significant investment in that entire offense. You know, like we talked about James Conner earlier in the show. From a best ball perspective, like I would be happy stacking a lot of players from that Steelers offense. And I would say even Eric Ebron as like a tight end too or something, because I think he does have some extra touchdown potential that people might be underappreciating. But I want a lot of that offense in general.
Yeah, I have been in the all the best ball championships and stuff. I have been taking a lot of Smith-Schuster, taking a lot of Ben Roethlisberger, taking a lot of James Conner. I think that is like the one offense you could point to of being like just across the board, all these guys are around too cheap, basically.
Yeah, I like that.
All right, well there we go, Matt. Do you have anything to plug or any other ideas you've been kicking around that you want to put on wax right now?
No ideas really. I like to keep those to myself. We got the Action Network podcast, that's bumping up to 2 days a week now with NFL shows. And so we recently had Evan Silva and Ian Harditz come on to talk about quarterbacks, and we're going to continue to break down the various fantasy positions and talk strategy on that show. So be sure to check it out. And then we're going to have our customizable fantasy football cheat sheet coming out, I'd say within a week or so, and that's powered by the projections that Sean Corner, Chris Raybon, and I have created. And you can customize it for your league settings and kind of say I want to take more of a zero RB approach, or you know, a zero wide receiver approach, whatever it is that you kind of want to do. You can customize the cheat sheet and play around with it for your league. So be sure to check that out. And I believe in maybe a week or so that should be out.
All right, everyone, there we go. Follow Matt on Twitter. He's got the best Twitter handle in the game, at Matt F. The Oracle. Check out all of the stuff they have going on over at the Action Network, and we will be back soon.
These days, the hustle's nonstop. When you need to unwind, reach for a Coors Light. It's the only beer that's literally made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. You know it's time to chill when the mountains on the cans and bottles turn blue. Don't feel like running to the store? Get Coors Light delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. So kick back with Coors Light. It's mountain cold refreshment made to chill. Coors Brewing Company in Golden, Colorado encourages you to celebrate responsibly.